Good evening and welcome to this special Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report for June 10th, 2016. On today's program, University of Idaho Plant, Soil, and Entomological Sciences PhD student Chris Bauer presents his doctoral research on the giant Palouse earthworm to a Palouse Prairie Foundation meeting. As four more live specimens are found on Paradise Ridge this spring. But first, this news. Leaders of several Northwest tribes held a press conference in Mosier, Oregon yesterday, calling for an end to oil train shipments through the Columbia River Gorge. Mosier was the site of the June 3rd Bakken crude oil train derailment, which caused several train cars to catch fire and contaminated the city's water and sewer systems. Some oil was seen in the Columbia River as well, but the biggest concern was the risk of explosion. Nobody was injured when the 96-car oil train derailed, but part of the town, including a K-8 school, were evacuated. Yakima Nation Chair Jody Goody said, "We do not want fossil fuels at all coming through the Columbia River Gorge, at all. We truly see what is at hand. We are sacrificing and putting at risk the long-term benefit and well-being of our nations, our children, our grandchildren, those yet to come. The reality of the small percentage who reap the economic gain of those endeavors is not worth the long-term consequence that could potentially be endured by you and I." Union Pacific says a broken fastener may have caused the derailment. Warm Springs Tribal Council Chair Austin Green Jr. asked if it was just one bolt that caused the derailment on the miles and miles of tracks. How many more derailments are there going to be? Robert Kennedy Jr. of Waterkeeper Alliance was at the press conference. He said oil train traffic is a, quote, "chemical assault on our families, our communities, and our children." Kennedy said his niece was sitting on the Mosier School's field when the train derailed. National Wildlife Federation Senior Director Tom France says the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service should include considerations for grizzlies that might repopulate the central Idaho wilderness if the agency moves forward with delisting grizzlies in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. There are more than 700 grizzlies in the Yellowstone ecosystem, but there has not been any stable population of grizzlies in central Idaho since the 1950s, when hunters made them extinct in the area. The Fish and Wildlife Service says it has signed a memorandum of understanding with Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming to keep the grizzly population above 609 bears in the Yellowstone ecosystem and to allow hunting if the population gets above 680 in the ecosystem. Idaho and Wyoming have an agreement with the Fish and Wildlife Service to allow limited hunting. France told the Idaho Statesman the National Wildlife Federation supports delisting in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, but says the Fish and Wildlife Service, quote, "needs to have a narrative in their delisting rule that addresses whether grizzly bears in Yellowstone are important to rebuilding the bear population in central Idaho. They need to do this before they delist Yellowstone's population," unquote. After grizzlies are delisted in the Yellowstone ecosystem, they will still be protected under the Endangered Species Act if they cross Interstate 15, where it runs through the Centennial Mountains in the area near the Montana-Idaho border. Idaho Fish and Game Director Virgil Moore seemed to downplay any need to protect wildlife corridors between the Yellowstone ecosystem and other grizzly habitat. Moore told the Statesman, "There is no illusion that population needs to be connected to any larger population to survive. That population is sustainable in its own right." Conservation groups have long argued wildlife corridors should be protected between Yellowstone and Glacier National Park and the Bob Marshall Wilderness. Lately, environmental groups have given more thought to also protecting migration corridors between Yellowstone and the Bitterroot Mountains and the Cabinet Yak Grizzly Recovery Area in western Montana, which borders on Idaho. In the 1990s, President George W. Bush stopped a plan France worked out with sportsmen and the timber industry to reintroduce grizzlies in central Idaho after the proposal ran into political trouble. Republican Governor Dirk Kempthorne argued at the time, grizzlies don't belong in central Idaho because they are flesh-eating carnivores. The Idaho Statesman reports in the 1990s, federal grizzly bear biologist David Mattson researched grizzly habitat in the central Idaho wilderness and found the landscape could support up to 600 grizzlies even without the return of spawning salmon, which were a major part of grizzlies' diets. Four former Weyerhaeuser employees have filed a lawsuit in federal court in Eugene against the company for failure to keep their promise of lifetime health care benefits. The Associated Press reports the case may affect between 4,000 and 5,000 Weyerhaeuser retirees and their spouses nationwide. Weyerhaeuser, which is headquartered in Federal Way, Washington, has 21 days to file a response to the complaint. The company claims it made no legal commitment to employees. Last year, Weyerhaeuser ended its account to pay post-Medicare costs to all salaried employees who retired after 1990. The company said it saved itself $70 million by doing so. Plaintiff attorney Michael Hagland said the written notification that Weyerhaeuser employees would get medical benefits for life, quote, was part of the compensation package that these retirees accepted when they started their careers with Weyerhaeuser and passed on other opportunities in exchange for Weyerhaeuser's promise of a secure retirement that included lifetime health care benefits, unquote. The Washington Supreme Court yesterday ruled the state can commit mentally ill people to psychiatric hospitals for extended periods if they can show they are likely to commit a violent act. Attorneys representing two clients who were committed challenged a 2013 law that makes it easier to commit mentally ill people arrested for violent crimes, even after a court finds them incompetent to stand trial and attempts to treat them fail. Social and Health Services spokesperson Kathy Spears said the state is holding 19 patients under the state law, called House Bill 1114, at Western State Hospital and 9 at Eastern State Hospital. Recently, two Western State Hospital patients held under the law, including a man diagnosed as schizophrenic who was found innocent by reason of insanity of killing a woman, escaped, causing a massive manhunt near one of the men's parents' homes near Mount Spokane. Justices said yesterday the 2013 law only slightly changed the process for committing mentally ill people. Lawyers contended the law violates due process. The justices emphasized the state must continue to show the person is mentally ill and dangerous and must provide psychiatric treatment. The attorneys representing the patients were pleased with that part of the ruling. They released a joint statement saying these include that the state bears the burden of demonstrating at least every 6 months that the criteria for commitment are still present. The person is still mentally ill and dangerous. We are also pleased the court agreed that in order to keep these people locked up in the state hospital for long periods of time, the state must provide treatment that is meaningful and not just warehouse people. Washington Superintendent of Public Instruction Randy Dorn told the state Supreme Court they should consider closing public schools statewide until the state legislature does something to further the Supreme Court's order to fully fund K-12 public schools in the state under the 2012 McCleary decision. In a court brief filed Wednesday, Dorn said the state Supreme Court should seek ways to enforce the decision, which said under the state constitution, the state must fund basic education. Dorn said closing the schools would be a way to compel the state to act. According to the brief, the remedial penalty imposed by the court is completely ineffective. To motivate the legislature to seriously address the problem, the court must impose tougher sanctions. If the actions of the 2016 legislature were not sufficient to purge the contempt, what sanctions or other remedial measures should the court order? According to the State Office of Financial Management, the $100,000 per day fine, which the Supreme Court imposed in August, now totals $27 million. The brief says the tactic of closing schools was successfully used in New Jersey. It says, quote, closing the schools cannot be ruled out as a possible final remedy. Dorn, who is not seeking re-election this year, said the court is expected to review the case soon and could lift the contempt order, impose further sanctions, or take other action. Vancouver, British Columbia-based mining company American Kumo Mining Corporation has reached a deal with Chinese firm MCC8 Group in Hong Kong, which specializes in mining operations and investment management. American Kumo wants to build a large open-pit mine in the headwaters of Grimes Creek, 14 miles north of Idaho City, a mountainous site in the Boise National Forest. American Kumo said the $700 million deal, if approved, will keep local control of the mining project with its subsidiary, Idaho Kumo Corporation, headquartered in Boise, and also marks a significant step in paying for a feasibility study for the operation. According to the Associated Press, American Kumo reported it has discovered the largest unmined deposit of molybdenum in the world. The company also plans on mining large deposits of copper and silver. American Kumo estimates there are between 2 billion tons and 4 billion tons of precious metals at the location, worth $60 billion. American Kumo president and CEO Sean Dykes said the study will cost $100 million and will allow his company to better understand what is in the ground at Grimes Creek. At this point, American Kumo estimates the volume of the deposits to be about 65% molybdenum, 32% copper, and 3% silver. Dykes said the rest of the money will cover the mine's construction once government regulators approve it. He said the total cost of getting the mine operational could reach as much as $2.5 billion. Three Boise-based environmental groups are challenging the Forest Service's decision to allow the five-year drilling project to move forward. Idaho Rivers United joined with the Idaho Conservation League and Golden Eagle Audubon Society to sue the Forest Service in January, faulting the agency for approving the project without sufficient steps to protect water quality and rare flower habitat. Idaho Rivers United spokesperson Kevin Lewis said the Kumo project is a step backwards. Landowners, private companies, and conservation groups have worked together to restore stretches of Grimes Creek that were damaged by historic mining. Bull trout have recently been found in the watershed. We don't want this progress undone. The new Chicago police chief has hired former Spokane police chief Ann Kirkpatrick to head the Chicago Police Department's Bureau of Professional Standards. Kirkpatrick was one of three finalists for the Chicago police chief job, but Mayor Rahm Emanuel decided not to hire any of them and instead hired veteran Chicago police officer Eddie Johnson to be chief. Kirkpatrick was head of the Spokane Police Department from September 2006 to January 2012 and dealt with community outrage over the police killing of disabled janitor Otto Zem, who was tasered, hogtied, and held down with the weight of several officers on his chest in a Division Street convenience store in March 2006. After the Spokane County prosecutor declined to file charges, federal prosecutors filed charges and convicted one Spokane police officer, Carl Thompson Jr., of violating Zem's civil rights and lying to federal investigators. Kirkpatrick told the Spokesman Review she's ready for the challenges in Chicago, a city going through its own police brutality scandals. She said, "Those are storms, and I have already gone through many of these storms. Sometimes we need to embrace these difficult and challenging times." Since 2012, Kirkpatrick has worked as King County Sheriff's Office Chief Deputy and worked as an instructor with the Law Enforcement Executive Development Association, which contracts with the FBI for training. A small private airplane was forced to land without its rear landing gear at the Pullman-Moscow Regional Airport yesterday afternoon. Airport Director Tony Bean told the Daily News the double-engine Cessna slid about the length of a football field before coming to a stop. Both pilots were uninjured. Bean said it helped that the two people on board were flight instructors. The pilots discovered the rear hydraulics were failing to deploy landing gear around 5:40 p.m., prompting Pullman Fire Department and Pullman Police to arrive on the scene. Though the rear propeller and belly of the plane skidded, Bean said the plane only suffered minor scrapes where the plastic and the metal contacted the runway. Crews removed the plane less than an hour after the emergency landing took place. The airport was shut down during the incident, delaying one Alaska Airlines flight. The city of Troy's drinking water was in violation of a drinking water standard earlier this year, but the city government's newsletter, Troy Talk, says it's now safe to drink. A test in March 2015 found Troy's water exceeded acceptable levels of halocetic acid 5. The Idaho Department of Environmental Quality stipulates drinking water should not exceed 60 micrograms of halocetic acid 5 per liter. Samples collected in Troy averaged 68 micrograms per liter. The Troy City Council took steps to improve quality by amending the city budget Wednesday night to include money for replacement sands for the city's slow sand filtration plant. Troy Mayor Ken Whitney said he isn't sure what the cost of the sand will be, but estimates it will fall somewhere between $40,000 and $60,000. Whitney said he hopes the sand will be installed this summer. City Attorney Susan Wilson credited the city with a quick response. Wilson said the city is already working with the Department of Environmental Quality and has taken steps to decrease halocetic acid 5 levels, which were down to 40 micrograms per liter last March. Troy Talk newsletter said, quote, "If you have a severely compromised immune system, have an infant, are pregnant or elderly, you may be at increased risk and should seek advice from your healthcare providers about drinking this water." People who drink halocetic acid 5 that exceeds the maximum contamination level over the course of years have an increased risk of cancer. Troy historically has low levels of halocetic acid 5. Elizabeth Breaker of the Department of Environmental Quality said the perceivable rise could be due to a number of factors, including weather, maintenance, or the time of day. Breaker said halocetic acid 5 usually forms when disinfectants involving chlorine react with organic matter in water. We now turn to our featured segment. University of Idaho Plant, Soil, and Entomological Sciences PhD student Chris Bauer presented a summary of his research on the elusive giant Palouse earthworm to a meeting of the Palouse Prairie Foundation last night at the 1912 building. Bauer's research involved finding a way to definitively identify the worms, which have the scientific name Drillolaris americanus. He wants to be able to identify the worm's species by swabbing DNA rather than killing them, which is how they are definitively identified now. Bauer also has worked on mapping the DNA of the species, which have been found mainly in two geographical areas, the east side of the Washington Cascades and the Washington-Idaho Palouse region. Giant Palouse earthworm sightings were so rare that sometimes during the last century, there were decades between confirmed sightings. They became legendary for their size, but these specimens found in or near native Palouse prairie habitat remnants in Whitman County and on Paradise Ridge look very similar to the European invasive earthworms that are found almost everywhere in North America, called night crawlers. Here's Chris Bauer speaking to the Palouse Prairie Foundation last night.
To identify a giant Palouse earthworm, you have to euthanize them. And there's always this problem with juvenile earthworms. So if they don't have their adult characteristics, you just can't do anything. So this is why we wanted to use molecular methods, genetic methods, to address these problems. So all of that came together. My research goals was to develop a non-invasive diagnostic test. And non-invasive, I also mean non-destructive. We wanted to take advantage of what they're calling environmental DNA. So you might see this with wolves or ungulate elk, that when they leave their scat behind, you can recover the DNA, analyze that, and identify them, track them, determine their parentage. You can't do that with the earthworms yet. But we wanted to do this with earthworm casts. Well, I'll get into the details there. Estimate a phylogeny, and all a phylogeny is how this specimen is related to this specimen. So there was the Smoot Hill discovery. So there's been a spotty collection of giant Palouse earthworm since it was originally discovered. And there was some discovered over around Chelan, so the Eastern Cascades. And the big debate, or the big question was, well, are these the same species? All right, well, that's a good question. 400 miles apart. They don't move that far. They're not commuting. So how are they related? And so I wanted to estimate a phylogeny. And then Tim, actually, is going to be my collaborator. We're going to develop a predictive habitat model. So I'm a soil scientist, went out and collected soil data as well as sampled for eDNA, environmental DNA, and looking for the earthworms. We're going to develop a model that will give us sort of a heat map that will predict and say, well, it's likely that you would find a giant Palouse earthworm here, here, and here. Don't even bother looking over here. But my advisor tells me if you hold a giant Palouse earthworm and run your fingers along, because there should be, if you look at a clock, I'm like hidden in the eye, am I saying?
No.
Okay. You'd find, so if this is a cross-section of the earthworm, they have all different combinations, but you'll have closely paired. There'll be two pair, two pair, two pair, two pair. So maybe 11 o'clock, 1, 5, and 7. And those would be endogig. And the ones that hang out on the surface, like Lumbricus terrestris, they'll have two here at 8 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 7, and 5. Because they're traveling on the surface more. That's what the little hooks are for, the little bristles. But Jody tells me if you hold a giant Palouse earthworm and you run your fingers along the body surface, you don't really feel those setae because they're so small. But with Lumbricus terrestris, it's almost like sandpaper. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can really feel it. So if you do think you're looking at a giant Palouse earthworm, how do you collect them? And this is what I do. I carry a plastic baggie, Ziploc baggie with me. Or if you're just out, just use any plastic bag. Find some moist soil, not sopping, not saturated, just a little bit moist, or a paper towel or a cloth. Just the idea is you want to have a moist environment inside the bag. And I put a little air, so just pop a little air in there for a cushion. So if you put it in your knapsack, they are soft-bodied, they'll get crushed. And you want to keep them dark and cool, 60 degrees, or if you're European persuasion, 15C. You could get away with putting it in the crisper. So Cass dropped off some to me. I just turned my refrigerator down and kept them in the crisper until I got in the lab. They worked fine. And then note the location. GPS, of course, is best, but if you can point onto a map, that's fine with me. So these are some pictures. Joe Sazi found this one up on Paradise Ridge while he was mountain biking. So this is a picture, and I think he's probably 18, maybe about that long. Maybe that. So he decided he was going to bring it in. This is one that Cass collected, I guess, like 2 years ago. It wasn't on Iverson, but that's just what I called it. So here's where the bridge, but you can see where the platellum's going to form. So this is kind of what you can do is say, well, yeah, that's not 32 segments. That's probably 10 or 11. But this is what I mean when I say they look kind of lumpy. Is when they're starting to die, they just get lumpy like that, and they just don't make it. And then this is that bulbous tail I was telling you about.
That was University of Idaho Plant, Soil, and Entomological Sciences PhD student Chris Bauer speaking about his research on the giant Palouse earthworm at a Palouse Prairie Foundation meeting at the 1912 Center last night. Although it takes DNA or dissecting to definitively identify the giant Palouse earthworm, it can be easy to identify likely specimens by the location of the clitellum, or reproductive ring, 12 or 13 segments back from the head. Regular night crawlers' clitellums are about 30 segments back from the head. Giant Palouse earthworms are also bulbous at the tail end. One person who has been most successful finding likely giant Palouse earthworm specimens in the last 3 years is Cass Davis, who lives on Paradise Ridge. Davis said at the meeting he has found 10 live, likely giant Palouse earthworms, including 4 this spring.
Since I found the first one by accident, I noted it because I used to pull night crawlers and sell them to fishermen by the bucketfuls off the golf course as a kid. That's how I got beer money as a teenager. And I knew that it wasn't one of those, and so I picked it up. And another thing about it is if you have a handful of night crawlers, they'll produce a slime in your hand, a foamy slime. These guys, they're very watery. They just kind of drip a light fluid. It isn't foamy at all. It's very just drippy light. And where I'm finding them, I drive up Blaine Road all the way to the top of Paradise Ridge and down, and I stop during pouring rain, and I get out on the road, and I go through the worms. I'm an addict now. And they aren't there. And I walk the ridge in pouring rain. This is where I'm finding them, in deluges. And there's just one stretch of 100 yards where I found them. And what's odd about it is, like, here on Paradise Ridge where I find them, and I'm finding them because they're on the surface of the road. I ain't finding them in the brush or anywhere else. But you can go like this, and that road switches back around on that north side, just down the slope from it there. And I've walked out during many a pouring rain when I'm finding them up here, and they're not 100 yards downhill in the same forest, in the same terrain. Why are they in that area? And as I've said, we need to get up there and we need to start looking at some of those plant species and trying to figure out what's going on, maybe even look for moles who knows what relationships, what things have to the other, but there could be moles down lower that aren't up higher. Moles primarily eat earthworms. All sorts of things, but it would be really nice that as somebody takes on the new studies that we get a lot of that down and figure out what plant species are there and what we're seeing, what slopes we're on, what aspects. And I still have yet to, I want to walk the road on the other side where the potential highway may come in. And by the way, I'm also board chair of the Paradise Ridge Defense Coalition, and I want to let you guys know we're trying to stop that road from going over the crest of Paradise Ridge. The record of decision has been filed, and ITD is on the ground marking things up. We plan to challenge them all the way along legally, and if you want to help us, the attorneys we're hiring are very expensive. They say there's a fair chance we can stop ITD and make them come down, but do go to our website or perhaps our Facebook site and figure out how to donate to us, because these attorneys are expensive, but they're hot dogs out of Seattle, and if we want to meet ITD and keep that road away from the largest remnant of Palouse Prairie is on Paradise Ridge. So keeping that away, and I would really like to get on that south side on pouring rain down where they're going to run that highway, although we don't have the Endangered Species Act to protect them, you know. But as more science comes in, the judge's ruling was, quote, we know little about this species.
Is it about time to reapply?
I would love for somebody to try to reapply. That's another suit.
I think it's going to take 4 or 5 times if we don't keep it up.
Yeah. I've heard that an ESA listing takes petitioning 3-4 times. A judge will reject usually a couple times before they'll finally approve. And
wasn't the reasoning they're too rare to be too forced to know if they're endangered or not?
Well, there's just, we don't know. There's so little known that they don't know whether there may be thousands of them 15 foot underground, is what you know, they're basically saying, but we ain't finding them. I ain't hearing contractors find them.
Maybe there aren't.
I just find myself worrying a little bit that if you go to the same very small areas and pick up everyone you see, you're going to over-collect them.
Well, I walked that area of the ridge, and this is just what I found. And we've talked about it, and a lot of people talk to me about it. I'm an environmentalist, and they're coming to the surface there. There's robins. It's a hard pan road. There's nothing for them to burrow in. They're on. Last year, they dumped a bunch of gravel there because they're bringing all the equipment up. And I figured I wouldn't find any more because they had packed the road with gravel. But I'm still finding it up there. And by the time I get them to him, sometimes they're dried out. Sometimes they're in a mud puddle and they're so saturated
they're
dying too.
And
so there you're getting DNA on a worm that's probably going to die anyway. There's wild turkey all the way up there. There's a whole bunch of different creatures that are probably going to pick them up. You might go over into the soil and humus and put them in the ground and save them that way. But myself, I'm trying to bank on getting them on the endangered species list by giving scientists plenty of specimens so the judge won't be able to say next time, little is known.
And thank you for doing that, Cass.
That was Cass Davis, a former KRFP board member who lives on Paradise Ridge. Davis has found 10 likely giant Palouse earthworms on the ridge in the last 3 years, including 4 this spring. All of them were alive when Davis found them. Researcher Chris Bauer said one of the 4 Davis found this spring has already died in captivity. He said he has been trying this week to do DNA tests on the worms. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, 20% chance of showers Saturday, partly sunny, high 61, partly cloudy, low 41 Saturday night, and sunny, high 68 both Sunday and Monday. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscast you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843, or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. I'm Lee Robertus. Jim Roach and Scott Jackson assisted with tonight's newscast. If you want to find archived versions of the KRFP Evening Report, you can go to the KRFP website where all the evening reports are archived for downloading or streaming. Have a good night. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, Community Radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online.